Good evening. I would like to start by saying that it is really a pleasure for me to be able to facilitate or moderate this session. And before doing so, allow me to just share with you a few thoughts or maybe share some feedback from our meetings in Kampala. The implementer meetings, as you know, was held in Kampala in last July. More than 1,200 people were there. The meeting was very participatory and co-sponsored by different key agencies, including Global Fund, PEPFAR, UNAIDS, WHO, and a global network for people living with AIDS, and World Bank. It was a very successful meeting. I had the privilege myself to participate to all the implementers' meetings. And I can say that it's always fascinating to see how much energy is there because people coming from the field, because people talking about real implementation issues and trying to link that, of course, to how much progress we are doing. And it was quite interesting to find out that Kampala, we had almost 73% of the people who are participating were coming from civil society groups or communities members, which is a quite important numbers comparatively to the former implementers' meetings. And even 77% of the speakers were representing civil society groups. So for me, that was very important to see that the abstracts and orders which were requested, most of them, and accepted, most of them, were coming from directly people who were concerned by implementation. The meeting underscored significant progress and also some gaps. I don't want to go too much on detail because we have a great panelist with us today who will be able to talk about it better than I can do. But most of the countries presented have seen a twofold increase in the number of people on IRT. Progress in PMTCT has been shared throughout the meetings. Many examples in implementing male circumcision was shared. There was, however, concern that the discussion was by and large limited to a public health approach as opposed to multidisciplinary bias. Several sessions highlighted programs that target children and women. Also, model of masculinity as an issue emerged during the discussion. I want to particularly mention that the whole discussion around harmonization, simplification, alignment to national priorities, and how to improve the ownership of the countries were throughout of the meetings central to the discussion. But leaving Kampala, I can say that one major recommendation I could say coming from most of the implementers was to really think about prevention. And particularly the issues of national level accountability and ownership of prevention programs. So I will stop here and I will turn to our great panelist. I will probably start with François Vanter. François, could you just take 30 seconds to introduce yourself? I'm sure you will do it better than I can.
I'm François Fent. I'm a clinician who works in Johannesburg, largely with adult patients, although we have a substantial pediatric population, for a university-linked research unit.
René?
I'm René Pini. I did work 5 years with WHO. I recently moved to UNICEF, where currently I'm coordinating PMTCT and pediatric HIV in the health section in New York.
David?
David Harrows. I'm a senior associate for external relations and policy for the PEPFAR office in Kenya. Previous to that, I worked very closely with Michelle for UNAIDS for about 5 years out of the Washington, D.C. office.
He was my boss in Washington. Thank you very much. I think I will ask François to just take the floor and share with us his thought about best practices for HIV/AIDS implementers and highlight from Kampala. Thank you very much.
And thanks for sticking around this evening. I'm quite amazed that people would stick around.
Yes.
This is a series of sound bites, essentially, of two very long rapporteur sessions that were actually used to summarize up at the end. As I said, I'm a clinician, which means, firstly, I have a very short attention span, and secondly, things have to be kept quite simple. So I apologize to people in the audience who were at the meeting and had very good research that I've overlooked or which I've misrepresented in any possible way. So this is going to be a whirlwind of a series of relatively unrelated, in some cases, studies and insights that develop from the conference. Obviously, for practically, particularly in developing countries, when and what to start is a constantly evolving debate. Sometimes it's a bit of a non-debate in places where the coverage is very, very poor or where the CD4 count is very low, but it's something which was an interesting thing. And Elliot took us through some really interesting analyses of adult national antiretroviral guidelines. He looked at the PEPFAR coverage countries and then sort of the focus countries and then looked at the guidelines and whether or not they were consistent with a series of guidelines. And what he demonstrated is that the vast majority of them were consistent with the World Health Organization guidelines. That 13 of the 15 PEPFAR focus countries had as the initiation level ART between the 200 to 250 level, which is, as you know, has been recently updated by WHO in 1996 to be pushed up a little bit further. And I do know that many of the countries subsequent to this meeting are now entertaining the idea of pushing it close to the 350 number. It's important debate, but in many ways for me as a clinician, it's a relatively academic debate where most of our patients are initiating therapy usually in almost all the countries below 100. You know, you can push it up to 800 if you wanted to, but it's not going to make much difference in terms of patient care. Also interestingly, looked at what people have done to change their guidelines, and I think that in many of the countries now the first line preferred regimen is either includes AZT or tenofovir. In almost all the countries, stavudine dosages have been reduced. South Africa, which is the biggest, has only took quite a while to make that reduction, to make it policy, but most people are now on to the 30 milligrams, which has been associated with a substantially lower morbidity. Second-line regimens, where they were available, were consistent with WHO guidelines. Six of the seven countries, of the remaining countries, continue to use stavudine. I think people often forget that the majority of Africans are actually started on stavudine-containing regimens, and in many other parts of the world as well. Tenofovir and 3TC are recommended in 5 countries if there's chronic hepatitis B present. Obviously, again, in Southern Africa, hepatitis B, and in many other countries, hepatitis B is a major problem. Tenofovir was used as second line in 8 countries. Botswana was used, and there was a very, I hope many of you went to the Botswana presentation yesterday, because I think Botswana, in many ways, is becoming in terms of outcomes as well as in terms of its program as a whole, one of the model countries in terms of how to approach an antiretroviral program. I'm from South Africa, and I'd say that we have a lot to learn from our very small neighbor next door. That when they pushed up their CD4 count number from 200 to 250, that theoretically would mean an additional 20,000 additional people annually who would qualify for antiretrovirals, or immediately would qualify for antiretrovirals. They're also moving across to tenofovir. And there was a lot of talk as to the cost for the country and whether it justified the cost that these two interventions, the switch of drug and the switch of CD4 count, would do. In Zambia, they've switched to tenofovir, and one of the problems they ran into was an immediate mass movement across by healthcare workers borne by patient demand in terms of tenofovir. And it's interesting because in my own country, tenofovir is being considered, although probably not as first-line therapy. We'll probably continue with D4T. But the transition across to tenofovir was actually very popular and unanticipated and caused a huge burden on the parts of the procurement agencies. In Namibia, they've moved across from D4T to AZT, and predictably there was an increase in the number of patients with anemia. I suspect predictably if they follow them up, there'd be a decrease in numbers of peripheral neuropathies and lactic acidosis. And there was a lot of concern about the cost of transfusion and of use of erythropoietin, although I think most of us clinicians would say you shouldn't be using erythropoietin. And there was a lot of concern about increasing the cutoff point to 350, although no hard data to really support the fact that this would have a huge impact on the program. Charlie Gilkes updated us in terms of the new WHO guidelines. As you know, with pediatrics, after the SHER study released last year, the idea that children should be that children who are identified by PCR techniques, infants who are less than 12 months who are identified as HIV positive, should actually be initiated on antiretrovirals. This has profound implications for programs. It's not as simple as saying if you find them, make it happen. You have to then have PCR testing available within the sites, rapid access to treatment, and then all the complexity of treating infants. But I think that there is a general sense that we need to be moving towards this. And I think he also just highlighted the fact that WHO moving towards this 350 number with WHO 3, which I think the continent as a whole is steadily going towards. But as I said to you, you have to ask yourself how much of an impact would this make on the average patient when our average CD4 count number when we start is less than 100. In terms of side effects and toxicity, I think this was one of the best presentations of the, well, for me, I mean, I'm a clinician, kidneys are like things we do. Was Karen Bolton's group showed a very interesting study that showed incredibly high mortality at baseline, one of the strongest correlates of mortality when patients had baseline renal creatinine clearance compromise. And in fact, I haven't got many graphs because there were so many slides, but in fact showed even with mildly decreased creatinine clearance, there was a very, very high mortality rate. Don't confuse this with the debates around tenofovir. This was, most of these patients were started on D4T or AZT. But in fact, this might be, when we talk about what we should be doing for patients when we start screening them prior to initiating antiretrovirals. I think increasingly as clinicians, we have to start entertaining the thought that we should be probably doing urine dipsticks as a routine on all patients before we initiate them on antiretrovirals. Most clinicians would tell you that we should be doing that on all patients anyway, but when you look at this data, it starts suggesting to us that we're looking, based on an African-American data as well, is that amongst black Africans that the burden of renal disease is actually grossly underestimated and that we might be looking at a huge problem going forward. Dr. McConnell presented data which many of you will be familiar with. It was a follow-up from Croy, but essentially very reassuring data that if in women who are exposed to single-dose nevirapine, again, remember that, you know, AZT-containing regimens, even though they're on paper and most women are quite lucky to even get single-dose nevirapine, there's a concern that will these women suppress when they're given full-dose antiretrovirals that have an NNRTI dual nucleoside backbone? Will they suppress? And again, the data is fairly suggestive that they will if they're given enough time beyond a six-month period to actually almost wash the resistance out, is, I suppose, the crude way to express it. And this is very reassuring. What it underestimates, though, is the structural problems of trying to rapidly move women from the PMTCH program who deserve full antiretroviral therapy into ARV programs so that they don't have to be subjected to single-dose nevirapine and then have to go on to less effective antiretroviral therapy within that six-month period. Adherence and retention in care has obviously been a theme. There was an excellent series of talks yesterday and today at this conference on this, but practically people have found that using patients who are actually on antiretrovirals as a mechanism for actually bringing people back into care is very, very useful. Peer educators as defaulter trackers. My own unit's had a lot of experience with defaulter trackers. It's a very cost-effective way to keep people in care. Simply tracking down people and bringing them back into care is certainly in our context has been shown to be highly cost-effective, although in other countries, it's poorer countries, the cost-effectiveness is maybe a bit lower. Something we don't use in terms, I never hear this in terms of adherence. I hear a lot about pill counting and of, you know, all sorts of other interventions. Pharmacy refill records is probably the most, is one of the best ways of actually demonstrating patient adherence. And there was data again to suggest that this is a good way to go about it. Nice, simple, cheap. Did your patient come pick up their prescription? You know, it makes sense. There was a lot of attention to this term I'd never heard before, MARPs, or most at-risk populations. Drug users, sex workers, you know, in many ways the localized epidemics that you see in Asia and certain parts of Africa and within the generalized epidemics, high-risk groups within this. Certainly in this study from Indonesia demonstrating that if you were going to tackle the epidemic in Indonesia, that intravenous drug users are a very high-risk group and need to have, and prisoners are another very high-risk group, that we need focused attention in Indonesia on these groups. And just very, very high rates of TB. So when you try to find TB and HIV, you can generally find them there as well. These slides are available, by the way, just because I'm skating over them so quickly. The extended presentation is available on the website, the PEPFAR website. And this study from Ukraine, again, demonstrating very high rates of illness amongst injecting drug users. And again, I think the lessons here for us is that, you know, to ignore these populations is a huge mistake. That that there's substantial evidence that needle exchange programs, that directed interventions at these groups, often where there's crossover with sex workers, are highly effective in terms of HIV prevention. In Ethiopia, completely off the issue of at-risk populations, there was a lot of attention given to retention and care. And one of the things we're, again, struggling with is how do you keep people with a chronic illness healthy, taking their medication for decades after you've put them there. And what they've demonstrated here, and it was interesting because there's a similar study this afternoon at this conference, is that the further away somebody lives from a facility, and the more likely they are to fall out of care. And again, this concept again and again, it was recurring throughout this afternoon, was decentralized care has to be the way we need to go. People need to be able to pick up their medications at a time that's convenient to them, not at one that's convenient for the healthcare system. A South African study looked at, actually mistakenly deleted the second slide, but essentially looked at gender and HIV and outcomes. And again, there was a study this afternoon suggesting something similarly, that men do slightly worse than women in terms of the long term, over the first 6 months to a year of antiretroviral care. There were some confounders. Women tended to be younger when they entered into the antiretroviral program, and certainly in South Africa we've seen that again and again. Tended to have a slightly higher CD4 count. How significant, clinically significant, a difference of 15 cells is difficult, and a better body mass index, a lower WHO staging as well. In terms of children, there were several studies. This particularly interesting one was looked at children and demonstrated that, you know, had, if they weren't started on antiretrovirals, we see this in adults as well, that children get lost to follow-up. That there's a lot of, that people, I think a lot of patients, a lot of mothers, a lot of parents don't feel like they're taken seriously enough when their children are not started on antiretrovirals. Also, obviously, that these children might be dying at home. In the SHER study, a huge number of the patients actually died at home suddenly and unexpectedly of these children. Turning to laboratory data, now laboratories in Southern Africa and in developing countries in general are hugely problematic. The infrastructure is very poor, quality systems are very poor. There was a Maputo declaration that asked governments to commit themselves to a national plan to develop laboratory systems. That we need integrated laboratory care. Having standalone laboratory systems for TB and HIV make absolutely no sense. You have to improve the system so that you can get a glucose and you can get an HbA1c in the same way that you could expect to get an HIV test or CD4 count. That coordinating mechanisms and stakeholder collaborations have to be taken forward. And repeatedly what was emphasized during these sessions was the issue of quality. That quality control slips down the agenda, everyone pays lip service to it, and then we see everything falling apart. And we've had several poor experiences in South Africa in terms of HIV testing, where if you don't monitor quality again and again, the sensitivity and the specificity starts falling, and that the community perception of HIV testing, for instance, takes a battering. TB screening, there were some TB was one of the best sessions actually at the Kampala. So, a whole lot of looks at TB screening and TB initiatives and TB integration, some really amazing stuff. But also good stuff from the laboratory, how to improve our detection, looking at sending people into homes to collect sputum, different concentration techniques to try and improve TB sputum. For those of you who don't know, it's a very laborious way of actually diagnosing TB. The staining process and looking at it under the microscope is a very high burnout rate amongst the technicians. And then using fluorescent microscopy to actually improve the case detection rate. Early infant diagnosis, as I said to you, if we are going to be able to find them, if we are going to start them on antiretrovirals, we first have to diagnose them. And that's a huge scale-up problem for laboratories. These PCR testing is difficult and has consequences. And people were dealing with this a lot in the sessions, again linking it to laboratory quality assurance programs. And as I said to you, I work with a lot of laboratory people, and they say this is the thing that nobody talks about, is it's expensive to run QA programs. Nobody costs it, and everyone chops it off their budgets, even when they do cost it, as when they're trying to slash back. I'm going to rush through the last bit, the care and support sessions, which looked at a host of areas of care and support. And again, you might be a bit bewildered at the variety of stuff, but as I said to you, we try to summarize 3 days with sometimes 8 or 10 sessions. In terms of adult care, again, retention in care, this was a scary study where, and I think we've seen it in our own programs again and again, and there was again sessions throughout yesterday and today, which just shows this incredible loss to follow-up between the point of diagnosis and the point of staging and the point of actually initiation to care. There's been good data from Cape Town to demonstrate that the majority of the mortality we see in African certainly programs, and I suspect throughout the world, is actually seen prior to starting antiretrovirals. So when people, there's a lot of focus on decreasing mortality in the 3 months immediately after initiation of antiretrovirals. In fact, if we accelerated access to antiretrovirals, we probably have a far greater impact on mortality. And this study certainly sort of supported that, but demonstrated this incredible loss to follow-up of people actually entering the system. And there was a follow-on study from this showing that in very small numbers, but showing that if they actively managed the down-referral, the up-referral process to the site, that loss to follow-up was a lot lower. Wafa Elsado had a fascinating study, which is again in the same vein, which looked at pregnant women. Now, you have to remember, pregnant women often have a much higher CD4 count. That CD4 count's a little bit hemodiluted. You have to have a certain level of health before you can become pregnant. So these women are often much healthier than the general adult population that starts on antiretrovirals. And what was fascinating is, if you look at her, again, look at her data, the fall down from from getting your HIV positive test to having your CD4 count down, and then look at this, the percentage you're eligible for antiretrovirals, somewhere about a quarter to a third of them. But look at that phenomenal fall down between the sort of middle graph, which is a sort of yellowy color on my graph, to the orangey, pinky color towards the end, between the four quarters. You can see how few of these patients actually managed to start out during that period. And we've seen this in our TB programs, in our pregnancy programs, everywhere. It's this phenomenal fall down. But you can see when she actively intervened how much things had improved by the fourth quarter. So these are not... these are not problems which we can't get over, but there are problems we have to recognize where the issues are and target where we're losing these patients. This was a fascinating little study as well, looking in Thailand at quality improvements. You know, this is the non-sexy stuff that actually saves far more lives than developing new drugs and new diagnostics and things, but actually making sure that what we know works is actually implemented. And certainly here where, as you can see, ART provision and PCP prophylaxis was being done relatively well. CD4 count testing and TB screening wasn't. And by actively managing that process, by, in this case, going through a whole lot of quality improvement initiatives, they were able to improve, as you can see, the CD4 count and TB screening rates to almost 100%. And certainly in our own clinics, where you just make the staff aware that they're being watched, that they're being audited, that they're being supported, that they're being trained appropriately, and what the consequences of not doing these things, you do see healthcare staff actually altering their behaviors. Ted Ellerbrook and a whole host of very brave people are putting together a manual to try and help people within these clinics practically deal with scaling up HIV prevention and care. this document is being circulated. It's the so-called living document on the internet. But to quote Ted, he said he doesn't want this to gather dust in the clinic, which is the fate of most manuals in my experience, in certainly in the clinic. So there's a lot of activity around this with this WHO PEPFAR collaboration looking at this operations document. And I urge some of you just to pay attention to how it's being developed, because I think there's going to be a lot of pilot. There already has been some piloting, but a lot more is to come. So what was good about this conference is something I haven't seen much of here, certainly so far, but a lot of focus on palliative care and practical palliative care, actually confronting a lot of the nonsense that stops, you know, quality palliative care getting out there. There was a whole series of sessions looking at the quality of palliative care provided and training, and, you know, whether morphine was available, simple little interventions like this. A whole range of sessions were addressing this, looking at the legislative framework that stops people having access to these therapies. So looking at policy, what medications actually are available. In my own country, just getting a drug as simple as amitriptyline available in the primary healthcare center has all these regulatory frameworks stopping it from being dished out. The education framework, I think internationally we know that palliative care has to be actively intervened around in terms of making clinicians aware of it. And finally, implementation. How do you count? It was quite interesting seeing an audit. There was one specialized audit that only looked at palliative care and obviously showed dismal results, but improvement with time. Pediatric care, again and again, this issue of the delinking of PMTCT from actual access to care for the mothers. You know, simply the endpoint being an HIV-negative baby not being acceptable in our programs. I think nobody in their right mind would go for that, but that is the reality of many PMTCT programs. They're ending up with focusing on getting the verapine down the throats of the moms so that the baby's tested negative. And we know that that's not a great way to run a healthcare system. So there were quite a few sessions trying to meld these two, but it's not easy. It's much easier said than done. There were two or three sessions that actually showed that children who are not initiated on antiretrovirals are lost to follow-up in many cases. So we need to somehow keep people in care, both adults and children who don't get antiretrovirals. HIV counseling and testing, there were a large number of sessions on this. Again, people emphasizing that if you just give somebody an HIV test outside of a context of care, that it's not terribly useful. And these three sessions actually emphasized that. There was a lot of discussion about HIV testing and about just one-time interventions like testing and leaving people alone with that diagnosis without actually retaining them in care. And I think all of us clinicians are actually grappling with those healthy patients who don't need antiretrovirals, because there's very little we can actually offer them beyond the classic support group model, which is actually not working for a large number of our patients. This again demonstrated this huge loss to follow-up, number of positive people identified in the Uganda routine HIV testing, and the number actually enrolled in care in the same facility. We've done a similar study in one of our largest clinics in one of the rural areas of South Africa, and that number is 53% there. It was 76% in our. If you do not give people antiretrovirals, they see no real point to sticking around. And we need to find better ways to holding on to them and making sure that they stick around and take what they need. So finally, onto TB and HIV. I think this was just one of the graphs, more to pepper up the study, so there's not too much the talk, so there's not so much text. But you can see that there's been a steady improvement in the TB notification rates. Now, you might be a bit of a cynic and say that maybe it just shows that TB rates are going up. I think quite clearly there's more and more consciousness around TB, and I think while the XDR is a terrifying thing, I think one of the things that it's brought with it is a far more consciousness around things like infection control and just TB in general and what a disaster TB actually is in sub-Saharan Africa. There's been lots of progress. As I said to you, this was one, even though it comes across as incredibly dry, and I was dreading going to the session, it was one of the best sessions in Kampala. It was the whole issue of TB-HIV integration. How can we bring HIV testing and antiretrovirals and try and integrate the two when traditionally there's been quite a separation? The three I's, there's been a sense of branding some of the TB interventions, and the three I's, which are going to be bandied around more and more, is intensified TB case finding, which has been actually quite successful in many cases. There were a lot of countries which showed some benefit. And I'm a bit of a cynic about TB case finding, but I think there was quite suggestive data to show that there are a lot of benefit to it. INH prophylaxis and all the issues around it. And then something very close to my heart, which is the whole issue of infection control. For the first time, people are saying, you know, we need to start talking about TB infection control seriously, because if it is such a disaster, we should be doing something about it. Food and nutrition, I wasn't at a lot of these sessions. My sense of nutrition often is there's a lot of hand-wringing about nutrition with very little help. And what you're dealing with is a systematic food crisis situation in Southern Africa, which is actually where the HIV epidemic just makes it worse. You know, and your malnutrition is obviously a pretty grim thing, and it has impact in terms of HIV. But it has an impact on the society as a whole. And there was good research last year to demonstrate that food insecurity is one of the risk factors attached to HIV acquisition. So again, there was some discussion as to how can PEPFAR do this without paying for the food crisis, which obviously could consume several budgets over and over again. I'm almost done. This is just a little study on peds, which was just a little bit interesting. That again, our obsession with orphans and showing that actually, you know, an orphan is an orphan. In my own country, there's an obsession with HIV orphans. Now, I don't really know what the difference is, whether your mother died because she had AIDS or because she got hit by a bus. You know, I think pretty much an orphan is an orphan. And that pretty much the social problems that go with being an orphan, the poor social structures that are there to support you, would probably hold for everything. And yeah, this study just demonstrated is that that looked at school attendance, which is a good, which is a fair proxy for health in children. Showed, in fact, it wasn't the orphan status, but all the socioeconomic variables that were attached to it that were far more predictive of whether children went to school. And the single-minded focus on orphans, while obviously orphans are an incredibly vulnerable group and need specific tailored interventions, obscures what is actually a much more generalized and systematic problem with children who do not have access to resources. So this is the final slide, is that there's been a lot of progress made on all fronts. I think we've made a lot of mistakes operationally. There's this term a little bit on the third thing, build the ship while we're sailing. We've been in the midst of a crisis. The PEPFAR program is an emergency plan, and I think there was a lot of stuff we couldn't really think about and we didn't predict for. But there's been a lot of progress made on a lot of these fronts, and I think we've started to learn lessons as we're going along as to what does and doesn't work. How much of it's rhetoric, how much of it's real, how many of them, you know, in my own programs, the number of mistakes that we've actually made are huge and in number. How can we get better integration and linkage to prevention? I think you heard earlier about how it was all about prevention. We still haven't nailed that one by any means. And certainly within our treatment programs, I need all the help I can get. That this packaging of care, again and again, came to the fore. But that package has to be different. What you give to a child who's poor is very different to what you need to offer to an adult who doesn't need antiretrovirals. It's very different from a pregnant woman who's now got a child at home who's screaming, who's trying to deal with the fact that she's recently put on antiretrovirals. And the final comment here, that, as I said earlier, is that OVC policies can't be simply focusing on orphans. They have to be looking at the broader social context in which children are living, which is often a pretty grim reality in sub-Saharan Africa. So I'd like to thank you all for your attention. I apologize to all the people whose research I've skimmed over or misrepresented or just never put into the slides. As I said to you, the full slides are available on the website, and a lot of the data that I've left out is probably available to you there. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Francois, for this really very good summary and updating us on what was happening on science side from Kampala. I will open the floor now just to react on this presentation, because we are going through three presentations. We will not even remember what he was saying. So please let us be provocative and ask a difficult question to Francois. Who will? Yes, please.
I just have a question about the finding that that orphanhood should, you know, that we should start taking into account various reasons for vulnerability. The PEPFAR definition for orphans is very limited and restricted to only HIV/AIDS orphans. So I'm confused about how, you know, the findings from Kampala show that we should be addressing all, you know, all orphans and all vulnerable children. But the PEPFAR policy and the PEPFAR definition is very targeted towards only children who are made vulnerable by HIV/AIDS. So maybe others on the panel could also answer the question, will PEPFAR policy change based on those findings?
I mean, I'm not a
PEPFAR defender of policy, and there are lots of those definitions which don't work for me. I agree with you, and I think most PEPFAR people after seeing that data would agree with you completely. I think what worries me about PEPFAR is that somebody once explained to me and said, you know, the AIDS poverty in Africa is this big, HIV in Africa is this big, PEPFAR is this big. What can you do with your PEPFAR budget in the most effective way possible? I would argue that you're correct, though, is that focusing exclusively on orphans doesn't really make complete sense to me, and that they need to find a better definition for who needs to be the most vulnerable. But my sense of PEPFAR people is that they generally look at that data quite critically and then evaluate it after that. And I hope that they do take it into account. I'm not, unfortunately, on those committees, so I won't be able to argue it. But.
Anyone want to, David, you want to just come in?
Sure. I mean, I think that, you know, with all of the PEPFAR policies, whether they're related to orphans, nutrition, I mean, all the limitations that I think were referenced in the slide, I mean, I think that, you know, it is a situation where we do have to draw some lines. I think where those lines are drawn is an evolving science and something that, you know, I think in the next phase of PEPFAR, we may have some more flexibility to look at that differently. But I do think part of the success of PEPFAR has been in some of its definitions of if we have 10% of the money within PEPFAR going to orphans, then, you know, there are lots of orphans vulnerable because of HIV that we need to access. And that doesn't mean that that covers all of the orphans that are vulnerable or all the orphans we need to reach. But I think that there's still some discussion to be had about exactly where does PEPFAR start and end and where do other things pick up.
Thank you very much. Please, you have a...
My name is Dr. Hugh Luemba from Canada. Dr. François Vantel, you say that PEPFAR has made a lot of mistakes over the last few years. Can you just give a little bit of more emphasis on those mistakes?
I've made lots of mistakes.
But could you share your mistakes?
So I think one of the things we haven't focused enough, and this is not directed at PEPFAR, it's directed at healthcare systems,
yeah,
is we haven't focused enough on retention and care of people who are not on antiretrovirals. Even if you come to this conference, you'll see a massive amount of studies on how well we've done. Like, you'll see Kaplan-Meier graph after Kaplan-Meier graph of patients started on antiretrovirals and what's the difference between this patient who had TB versus that patient. If you look at the patients before they go onto antiretrovirals, the mortality in children and adults is absolutely astounding. And I think that we haven't been creative enough as to how do we get somebody diagnosed with HIV, keep them in a healthcare system that's very, very poor, to be honest, and actually get them onto antiretrovirals when they're still healthy. So for me, the biggest loss in the last the biggest realization for me is that I focused a lot on getting access to care and getting people into treatment and trying to, like, treat the iris and all the rest of the stuff. When in fact, I would have saved a lot more lives if I'd accelerated the access to antiretrovirals in the first place and tried to have innovative programs in terms of dealing with stigma, in terms of dealing with accelerated HIV diagnosis, and accelerated adherence monitoring. I think we've created an absolute monster in terms of how much adherence pre-ART actually is emphasized. So that's, I have lots of other mistakes to tell you, but that for me would be one of the critical areas that we've messed up with, is we haven't looked at retention care. Second one, God. Children. I think that children has been one of my biggest frustrations in my program, is that we've done so well with adults. We've tried different models, and we've increased the access to care amongst adults dramatically. With children, we've tried to improve the access to PCRs. We've tried to train our healthcare workers to not scare them anymore. We've tried to get them to treat them better. But yet we still have not managed to increase the number of children who actually access care in the same way that we've increased the number of adults. And I think that children are actually a far more complex population to draw into care than adults are. And I think for that reason, I think, again, we need to go a little bit back to the drawing board and start looking. There was a lot of rhetoric around why children are not getting care. There was the rhetoric that, you know, they get pushed out, the adults are prioritized. I've been in clinics where we've absolutely used PEPFAR funds to, like, remove all those things, and the numbers of children have gone from 4 a month to 5 a month. And I think that there's a much more difficult social environment which children exist in, certainly in developing countries, which means that we need to tackle it on a far more structural level to actually get them into care. And simply, you know, having more PCRs may well not increase the numbers.
Thank you. Please.
Just actually have 2 points to talk about. One is about...
Could you introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Tariq Manji from Plan USA. We work with child-centered community development. And my first question is, again, around orphans. With the PEPFAR funding, it creates a bit of a problem when you say, you know, you identify a child as an AIDS orphan versus identify a child as an orphan. And when you go to programming and, you know, one child receives a benefit, another one doesn't, it creates a problem. Mm. How we deal with it is we let the community identify who they think are the most vulnerable. HIV/AIDS is high in that community, and so they are HIV/AIDS orphans. Now, it does create problems in terms of reporting and in terms of monitoring, but I think that's an approach that we would like to advocate for in terms of communities being more involved in determining who their orphans are and who need the beneficiaries versus the formula of saying, you know, clinically, your parents died of HIV/AIDS, so you will qualify and you won't qualify for the program. So I think there's different approaches to deal with that. On the other hand, you just made a comment about not being successful in pediatric AIDS. We've just done a pilot study in Uganda. It's called the Mukuju study, where we've actually done a PMTCT plus program. It's a learning site. It's small, but we serve a community of 170,000 people, and we've been able, you know, we have a compliance rate of 95%, and we've been able to, you know, help children go on ARTs, and we've had a really good compliance rate with that. But again, our program is not a PMTCD program, it's a PMTCD plus program, where we look at water and sanitation. We have social workers to counsel the children. We also look at nutrition in terms of sustainable livelihoods and gardens, village savings and loans. So if you do the classical clinic model, it's going to fail. If you do community approach, it will work. The problem is that PEPFAR funds are quite limiting in terms of extending into that community model. And I'm wondering if we can open the debate to talking a little bit about how you can have integrated programs that deal with other aspects around HIV/AIDS to address the poverty issues yet related to HIV/AIDS.
Am I allowed to be controversial?
Yes, you could.
Okay, good. So why don't you ditch your PMTCT program completely and stop calling it PMTCT plus? And why don't we talk about pregnant women as being the focus of our attention rather than PMTCT plus, which is about prevention of mother to child, and we'll just tackle mom as we go along. I think the biggest failure of PMTCT is that we haven't focused on women. It is one of the, we've demonstrated again and again that they're the easiest group to initiate antiretrovirals in. You get all the benefits of PMTCT. Why don't we just have a maternal health program for HIV-infected women? Rather than wasting our time with focused PMTCT interventions, which we know again and again have got incredible loss to follow-up rates, poor outcomes, and are very, very expensive, to be quite honest. And we've created parallel systems in the process. What you're describing is actually a maternal health program, not a PMTCT plus program. And that's what I think we should be starting to look for, is I think across the developing countries, you know, in developed countries, nobody talks about PMTCT. You talk about a mother who's in care. And if we started to behave more like that and start addressing it, the healthcare system, you know, you and I might think about a woman as being in maternal care. The system doesn't see it that way. The PMTCT program is inflicted on a crumbling healthcare system, and the people who implement it see this as something which is not their responsibility. And I think that we need to change the way we focus on PMTCT to be focusing exclusively on maternal health. And then those ones who have high CD4 counts, who do need single-dose nevirapine, which is a tiny proportion of them, we can deal with them, but we can retain them in care rather than have to deal with the consequences of yet another vertical program.
Thank you very much. I will ask now to Renee, please, to just share with us your feedback from Kampala.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I didn't want to anticipate what you were talking about, PMTCT. But anyway, I do actually have some information on PMTCT, which actually address this issue. And getting back,
Francois wants you to lose your job in.
Okay, I would first like to acknowledge the members of the prevention team listed on these slides. As Francois mentioned, it was a very tough work with outstanding contribution of all these members. I wanted actually to start my presentation with this outline, because I will take you through a long list of sessions and areas, and I didn't want you to get lost. So I will go through first the principle of not knowing your epidemic and knowing your response, addressing issues around most at-risk population, multiple and concurrent partnership, broadening the area of prevention service providers, military response to the HIV epidemic, prevention with people living with HIV/AIDS, prevention of mother-to-child transmission, key messages, and then a conclusion. Worldwide, within regions, countries, and communities, the HIV epidemic has various natures and impacts depending on the social, cultural, and economic context, individual behavior, sexual networks, and the responses of national governments. In order to be effective, national responses should be based on a good knowledge of the epidemic. There is now a global consensus that there is not one global epidemic, but different types of epidemics. In general, generalized epidemic and concentrated one are different regarding the person infected and how these persons are infected. The Americas, Europe, Asia, and the Near East are facing concentrated epidemics, with HIV being spread in one or more defined subpopulations. The epidemic in these parts of the world is not well established in the general population and will probably always remain concentrated. Finally, there is a need for a better understanding of the mixed epidemics in the Caribbean, West Africa, and Papua New Guinea. Talking of the response so far, program experience during this meeting have shown that concentrated epidemics driven by most at-risk populations can be prevented, stabilized, or even reversed through the implementation of effective targeted interventions. However, because of challenging environment, including policy and operational issues, programs targeting men having sex with men, and IDUs are still limited and have not been taken to scale so far. In generalized epidemics, countries have been slow in developing effective responses to address the well-known drivers. The main challenges include the need to reallocate efforts and resources for what has not been proven to be effective, to what has been proven to be effective. I'm talking especially here of the need to reduce partners and male circumcision that need to be applied at scale. National responses should define specific strategies for most at-risk populations. As part of the process, the following questions should be explored at national level. Are programs reaching the most vulnerable and at-risk and undeserved populations? Are they providing services appropriate to the population in an appropriate way? Can these be brought to scale and how? Various strategies linking vulnerable populations to comprehensive services were discussed during the meeting. This includes a multi-sectoral committee, ensuring that refugees can access the full range of HIV services in a camp in Rwanda, a national technical working group on injecting drug users and prisoners in Kenya, provision of brothel-based services in South Africa, caseworkers and training to reduce discrimination by healthcare workers in Russia. Multiple concurrent partnerships are among the main drivers of the HIV epidemic worldwide. Concurrent sexual partnerships is the practice of having long-term sexual partners that overlap in time, often for months or years. Models for reducing multiple partnerships include mass media communication, interpersonal communication and community mobilization, special programs and curricula for FBOs, CBOs, such as faithfulness training of couples involving religious leaders and text voice messages for the new generation of people. These strategies should be integrated into existing programs, including prevention outreach with peer education, TMTCT, testing and counseling, and life skills programs. Following the release of the results of three controlled clinical trials revealing that circumcision of HIV-negative adult males reduced the risk of acquisition of HIV through heterosexual contact, WHO units organized a technical consultation in March 2007. Participants to this meeting recommended that male circumcision be recognized as an efficacious intervention for HIV prevention, and countries should be supported to scale up it as a priority prevention intervention according to local context. However, it was emphasized that male circumcision should always be considered as part of a comprehensive HIV prevention package and should never replace other known methods of HIV prevention. During the meeting, it was suggested that national programs could link male circumcision and PMTCT programs through the provision of neonatal circumcision and circumcision of male partners. Despite the global slowness in rolling out male circumcision, some countries such as Swaziland, Zambia, have made significant efforts. In general, male circumcision is recommended for HIV-negative men. Data from countries have shown that complication rates are lower in medical settings as compared to non-medical and traditional settings, that rapid scale-up of male circumcision requires strong political support. At service delivery level, potential high demand balanced with HIV resource constraint might require innovative approaches to human resource constraints such as task shifting. Male circumcision should not be seen as a magic bullet. It should rather be implemented as part of a comprehensive prevention package. In this regard, WHO recommends the following minimum package of male circumcision services, which includes HIV testing and counseling, active exclusion of symptomatic STIs, and syndromic treatment where required, provision and promotion of male and female condoms, counseling on risk reduction and safer sex, surgical procedures, and post-op follow-up and ongoing risk reduction counseling. Talking of the service providers, the social dimension of HIV epidemic and the prominent role of people living with HIV/AIDS have led to repositioning community as an underpinning entity of HIV prevention, care, treatment, and support programs. In addition, the weakness of health systems in most affected countries require that we broaden the area of HIV prevention service providers. In this regard, at programmatic level, various approaches were described and models are being implemented, including peer educators or mentor mothers with mothers to mothers, the total control of epidemic TCE, training of clients to serve over implemented by TASO, and involvement of faith-based organizations. I personally was in this session and I found out that in terms of prevention, sending the right message, using the right wording is very important. While we are talking of knowing our epidemic, I think in this session where we had only militaries, we are talking of understanding the enemy terrain and counterattacking based on the finding. So military represents a special population. Experience from Uganda, Benin, and Lesotho shown during this meeting that militaries can run highly innovative responses to address specific situation and the culture of the military community, such as deployments in conflict areas which have high prevalence of HIV. Specific responses have been built around behavioral and serological surveillance, comprehensive decentralized approach to prevention, pre, post, and during deployment, including mobile testing and peacekeeping care after post-deployment health checks. Major challenges discussed include the role of confidentiality in military settings in the area of ART, compulsory disclosure to commanders and spouses, and exclusion of persons living with HIV from peacekeeping operations. Young people represent a special and vulnerable population, often neglected and inappropriately addressed by national programs. This population has special needs and therefore requires specific approaches with a critical role of peers. Approaches presented during the meeting include mass media campaign addressing gender norms and HIV prevention among young people in Cote d'Ivoire, partnership with Strict Youth in Kenya, participation of youth and peer educators in the review of curricula in Haiti, support to out-of-school adolescent girls with HIV education and referral, non-formal education, livelihoods, skills, and linkages in Ethiopia, and finally addressing cross-generational and transactional sex in Uganda. The session on prevention with people living with HIV emphasized the need to involve people living with HIV in developing and implementing prevention programs. Understanding their experience is critical for the development of meaningful prevention programs. Finally, to effectively address their needs, it is imperative to accelerate integration of prevention into HIV care and treatment settings. Key prevention programs targeting persons living with HIV are built around sexual prevention of HIV, support for disclosure of HIV status, counseling for discordant couples, sexual and reproductive health services including family planning, STI management and treatment, and stigma and discrimination intervention. Overall, during this meeting, very few presentations were on blood safety and awareness of injection safety. The focus of the abstracts presented was strategic management of supplies, awareness and involvement of the private sector, and collaboration with medical schools. In most resource-limited settings, PMTTT represents the main entry point to basic HIV prevention, care and support services for pregnant women, mothers, and their infants. Experiences from were shared on various issues, including the use of more efficacious ARV regimen for PMTCT, increasing access and uptake through innovation, infant feeding counseling and support, and best practices. This slide shows the global coverage of ARV regimens for PMTCT from 2004 to 2007. In 2007, 33% of HIV-infected pregnant women living in low- and middle-income countries receive ARVs, including ART, for PMTCT, compared to only 10% in 2004. This remarkable progress is partly due to increasing global and national commitment, local leadership, current funding opportunities, including PEPFAR and the Global Fund, and innovation to service delivery. Despite this achievement, the path toward the UNGA's 2010 goal of 80% coverage is still long and challenging. Data from South Africa and Lesotho highlighted the importance of implementing more efficacious ARV regimens as a critical component of intervention to prevent HIV infection from mothers to their children. Initiating ART in pregnant women in need of treatment significantly reduces the risk of HIV vertical transmission and addresses health needs of mothers, the ultimate goal being to improve maternal and child health and survival. Initiation of more efficacious ARV regimens in pregnant women require clinical and immunological assessment of women to determine whether or not they are eligible for treatment or prophylaxis. Experience from Malawi, Rwanda, and Mozambique shown that access to CD4 cell counts, reorganization of services, and monitoring of clinical staff significantly increased the number of eligible women enrolled for ARV prophylaxis and ART for their own health. Scaling off a comprehensive PMTC program requires that countries adopt innovative approaches to the delivery of a range of services needed by pregnant women, mothers, their children, and families. In this area, various experiences were shared. This includes HIV testing and counseling in labor ward for women with unknown HIV status in Zambia, facility improvement, outreach ENC PMCT, linkages with ART programs, quality control, community-based intervention, including involvement of male partners and peers in Nigeria, Tanzania, and Ethiopia. Infant feeding counseling and support is an area where further improvements still need for large-scale implementation of optimum infant feeding practices. Data from several countries reinforce existing evidence, including lower risk of HIV postnatal transmission carried by exclusive breastfeeding up to 6 months as compared to mixed feeding. The scaling of exclusive breastfeeding remains challenging, more often because of cultural infant feeding practices. However, evidence from Bolivia, Ghana, Madagascar, Malawi, and Zambia show that continued counseling and support can significantly increase exclusive breastfeeding rates. Data from Uganda show that HIV-free survival did not differ by feeding option, with a 12-month mortality rate significantly higher in the formula-fed infants. Before I conclude, I would like to share the following key summary messages with you from the meeting. First, know your epidemic. Successful HIV prevention programs require good knowledge of the drivers of the epidemic. As nicely stated by His Excellency the President of Uganda at the opening of the meeting, when you know the enemy and how he operates, you know how to respond. This means that we still need more research to inform global, regional, and national responses. Two, ensure synergies between prevention, treatment, care, and support programs, with HIV testing and counseling being the main gateway to services. Three, optimize the use of resources by selecting the appropriate intervention. This requires that we ensure that programs reach the most vulnerable, at-risk, and underserved population, including male having sex with men, IDUs, and sex workers. Prioritize specific intervention to address multiple concurrent partnerships as appropriate and address specific needs of young people. Four, promote and provide a multiple component prevention package combining behavioral, structural, and biomedical intervention. Five, broaden the area of prevention service providers and includes communities and people living with HIV. Six, PMTC should, in the first place, prevent new infection among women of childbearing age and increase access to more efficacious ARV regimens, including ART, for pregnant women in need of treatment. Seven, in fact, PMTC should go beyond infection averted and deliver on the goal of improved maternal and child health and survival. There is an urgent need for a strategic shift toward improved maternal and child health and survival by focusing on quality antenatal and delivery care, provision of more efficacious ARV regimen for PMTCT, including ART for women in need of treatment, increased access and uptake of cotrimoxazole prophylaxis, early infant diagnosis and initiation of ART, operationalize linkages with child survival and sexual and reproductive health programs. Conclusion. Despite accumulated evidence over the years, HIV prevention efforts remain insufficient. Indeed, there is an urgent need to re-energize, accelerate, and expand prevention efforts with allocation of more resources. However, the complex nature of the HIV epidemics call for prevention programs that link with other development priorities and human rights issues, especially in resource-limited countries. The theme of the implementers' meeting in Kampala was scaling up through partnerships. Reaching the goal of universal access requires strong national-owned response with continued support from the international community, including more funding, but also concerted and strategic partnership. Yes, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Chairman, the urgencies of the moment calls for synergistic contribution and not for attribution. Time for inclusion and not time for exclusion. This is probably the most important message we can take from this meeting. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. So open for your question, clarification, challenging René. Yes, challenge him, please.
It's Hugh Luemba from Canada again. There is an observation that once we're giving medication for preventing male-to-child transmission of HIV, once the child is born, most of the mothers in Africa cannot afford to feed their children using formula. And most of them make the choice, they're still making the choice of breastfeeding their children, making the children at risk of transmission of HIV. So my point is, what is your position on this issue? Because some of the experts now are trying to see if it is a possibility to let them breastfeed their children, but giving antiretroviral medication as well.
René?
Thank you very much for your question. I think this is very important because looking at what we have as current evidence, we do have some data, still limited, but we can actually show that by providing ART to pregnant women and also in the postpartum to women, even some time providing prophylaxis, what we call post-exposure prophylaxis, so kids can actually reduce the risk of post-exposure transmission. But when it comes to infant feeding, it's very important to stick up the evidence. And the evidence, as I pointed out in this presentation, is that first, exclusive breastfeeding is actually associated with lower transmission rates than mixed feeding. That's one. We all also know that in our settings, mixed feeding is almost the common practice. That means that in terms of at population level, one of the messages which actually try to provide is not only for HIV positive or HIV negative, but the whole population is actually to promote exclusive breastfeeding, because through this approach, and when we know that actually HIV, most HIV infected women cannot afford replacement feeding, then providing at population level exclusive breastfeeding is one way to address the risk of postnatal transmission. The third point is, as shown in these studies during the meeting in Kampala, when you compare formula feeding and exclusive breastfeeding, in fact, you do not have big difference, especially when you look at mortality. And the series of studies has shown that the mortality sometimes is higher in the group receiving replacement feeding, mostly due to the fact that, as you pointed out yourself, the formula feeding cannot be afforded by these women. And WHO in this recommendation takes into consideration the individual circumstances of women, looking at what we call the AFAS. So replacement feeding can only be recommended if it offers that meet, you know, acceptable, affordable, feasible, safe, and sustainable. Coming to the point of how ART providing the postpartum can reduce transmission, yes, but the process of developing guidelines with respect to this issue by WHO actually relates to the level of evidence we have. So far, we do not have enough evidence to recommend that treatment, either for the health starting for life or even for a short period in the postpartum, should be recommended as an approach to reduce postnatal transmission of HIV. However, WHO is planning a consultation in November in view of emerging evidence to discuss how the current recommendation, the current guidelines, could be revised based on the emerging evidence. And it's very important to take in consideration that during this kind of meeting, technical consultation, we are not looking only at the scientific evidence, but also at programmatic issues. Because you can make recommendation, but if this recommendation cannot be translated into action at country level, this cannot be helpful for national programs.
Thank you, René.
This is a little high. Hi, my name is Krista Lauer. I'm working in the United States with APLA. Thank you for your presentation and for pointing out the importance of addressing concentrated epidemics. And particularly given the plenary session this morning on MSM, I have a couple of questions. Given that consensual same-sex acts between men are criminalized in so many countries of the world, including, I believe, 10 out of the 15 PEPFAR-focused countries, I was just wondering, as implementers, your ideas and strategies for addressing the challenge of, one, knowing your epidemic, so being able to have an idea of the epidemiology of HIV among MSM, with due consideration for the risks of disclosure, and at the same time, ideas or strategies for reaching out to this population within that context. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your question. I'm not sure that I'm the right person to answer the question, but just my personal opinion. And the principle of knowing your epidemic, related to what I was saying, is actually also addressing all the factors surrounding the epidemic. When you're talking of men having sex with men, that means that you're looking not only at individual behavior, but also at societal issues around in terms of stigma and discrimination. And that's why it's important, and as I pointed out in the presentation, that in fact, we do not have one strategy. It should be a combination of strategy. You can have a biomedical intervention to address an issue, but it is very important to look at what is going on in terms of structural issues around, including issues in terms of stigma and discrimination, and how individuals actually link with the broader communities. So to keep it brief, I think, yes, there is an issue there, but national programs should address all these issues in a comprehensive way, including biomedical intervention, issues addressing societal issues surrounding the epidemic, and as I pointed out, knowing your epidemic is also defining clearly what will be your target groups. And by knowing your epidemic, you will actually then know how you can actually strategically use your resources targeting this group, knowing exactly what are the risk factor, the behavior of this population. And then by addressing this, we can maybe try to stop the epidemic. However, it's very important, as I pointed out, that yes, we are talking of concentrated epidemic, but at the same time, we should not forget that in some situation, it's actually sort of a mixed epidemic. At the same time, you have the epidemic growing in the subpopulation, you do have the general population, it should also be addressed in terms of needs and specific intervention. So again, getting back to the point that it's actually a combination of intervention. I guess I responded to your question.
Yeah, let me just maybe ask to the other panelists, because her question was a very pertinent question. It's all about bringing our programmatic response where epidemic is happening. But at the same time, you have policies, you have legislation, you have many laws which are criminalizing those people. So what we do with the fact of that? So could you just...
No, I think any right-thinking epidemiologist and scientist would agree with you. There's not nearly enough knowledge about many of sex with men. There's been more data more recently. I know Tim Lane's been publishing from some of the townships in and around South Africa, looking at men who have anal sex. And I think that, you know, I think we need to know our epidemic. That's the bottom line. I think there's been very broad categorizations of the African epidemic, which underestimates how complex the epidemic is. Certainly in my own country, there's still this concept of a high, you know, we've got a generalized epidemic in South Africa. there's still this concept of a high-risk group. And in fact, if you look at the Uganda data, the South African data, the Rwanda data, the high-risk group is actually married people. It's the only consistent thing that runs through all of the epidemiological cross-sectional studies is marriage is a risk factor. And the other thing that runs through it is that women are often the ones who are the first infected in the relationships. What do you do with that information? Instead, we stereotype people. It's the truckers, it's the sex workers, it's the men who have sex with men, it's the, you know, it's the young people, it's a whole range of things. Rather than interrogate what the data actually is telling you, and one of the useful things I heard from one of the CDC people is like, where were your last 1,000 infections? That's where you should be looking. And if it's in gay men, we need to go to gay men and start intervening there. If it's in married women, we need to intervene there. Instead, what's happening is this very one-size-fits-all, almost regional approach to our prevention efforts. And I think it's showing in the sort of the way, the fact that we're actually not making a hell of a lot of headway in terms of our epidemic. We need to get a lot smarter and a lot more sophisticated in terms of who's infecting who before we start planning our interventions.
Maybe one additional quick point, since the issue has been raised, is beyond that, I think we haven't been able also to adequately address issues around the multiple concurrent partnership, which is one of the main drivers of the epidemic. We should know exactly what are the key information we get with more research, but also defining clearly the type of strategies in terms of communication, in terms of behavioral change strategies to address this specific issue, especially in high-burden countries.
Any other question to René?
Maybe just briefly on that, yes, Michelle. Please, I know,
David,
we have
sorry,
time
yeah.
to move on.
No. We are.
I mean, I think that there. I think your point is very well taken. But I think as René and Francois pointed out, there's a programmatic know your epidemic, and then I think on the policy side, there's also what are the policy changes that we need to try and work with governments to try and amend so that we can really address the epidemic where it is. But I think the more we have data about where the epidemic is that governments believe and that we can work with them in helping to understand, the easier it is to have policy change follow. I think it's challenging, particularly in a place like Africa, where the evidence, we all know what's taking place, but I think the hard evidence of the epidemic among populations like men have sex with men isn't very strong. It's getting stronger, but it's not very strong, and that makes it difficult to work with governments in trying to understand this is a population that we need to reach. These are interventions that we need to reach that population with. We need to try and find ways on a policy and a programmatic level to deal with that fact. So I think it's an ongoing challenge for all of us. But I think the more evidence we have, and we'll get into this a little bit in the next session, on how do we use data to drive improving policies and enhancing policies, I think the better we'll be.
Challenging also in Eastern Europe, challenging also in Asia, challenging in the different places. So I think for a different reason, it's very important to really deal with your questions. If not, we'll not make a really proper breakthrough in our response. So, David, are you ready to?
Sure. Okay, I have the unenviable task of going last at the end of the day, so I will try and be brief for my benefit, since it's early in the morning Kenya time and also yours. This just went out.
Something happened, yeah.
No, the screen. Anyway, I can use these ones. It's fine. So this is the sort of cross-cutting presentation to complement the treatment and care and the prevention presentations from the implementers meeting. We've sort of labeled this the kitchen sink. I think that all of these are kind of the kitchen sink. We're trying to cover, as previous colleagues said, 3 days of very rich presentations in 15 to 20 minutes, hopefully less than that on my part. So I will try and run through this, but this certainly doesn't cover all of the detail and richness of what's available on the website, hivimplementers.org, and in the presentations themselves. Okay, so this is the cross-cutting and policy. I'll do a brief outline of sort of the seven or eight topics that were discussed. There are other topics that were discussed that aren't captured here. I think as Michelle pointed out at the opening, one of the most important things that was discussed and has been discussed at previous implementers' meetings and for quite some time now, and we've made some good progress, is sort of the harmonization coordination agenda, looking at how can we use national strategies, national strategic plans as really the basis to bring development partners, civil society, and others together around not just mobilizing more resources, but better using those resources and aligning those resources with nationally defined priorities, looking at some specific issues related to global funds, public-private partnerships, human resources, capacity building, and task shifting, all a bit falling in the same category. How do we create more capacity by training people, by working with institutions of training, et cetera? How do we better use the capacity we have through task shifting, moving into issues such as workplace programs? Those were referenced earlier as well. Strategic information, which came up at the end. Not just how do we better gather data, but how do we use the data that we have better to inform programming and policy. Looking at a couple issues related to procurement, although certainly not comprehensively, and then just a brief example of some of the many presentations on engagement of people living with HIV in the response and GPA. So first on harmonization, coordination, and national strategies. I think that it was observed, and Jonathan Brown spoke quite a bit about this, as did Michelle and others, but we've made some real progress. I mean, I think, as you'll see in a slide to come, in terms of coordination and harmonization, I think we've done better on HIV than we have in many other areas. That's not necessarily something to congratulate ourselves for, but I think we've made some significant progress. We should continue to push on that in the HIV context, but also use that as a way of pushing harmonization and coordination in other areas of development as well. The UN has certainly been a driving force, particularly UNAIDS, around the 3-1s, the global task team, and other coordination and harmonization initiatives. I think clearly, and you know, coming from the PEPFAR perspective, one of the major challenges is that we have a small number of donors that provide the vast majority of the funding, and trying to align those donors with national strategic plans and helping governments understand some of the limitations and some of the priorities that development partners bring to the table, and having a real conversation where those priorities can be leveraged through a division of labor, but also we can better align ourselves with each other's priorities. We still have issues of turf competition. There was some discussion around attribution. I think we've gotten better in that. I think we're particularly doing well on the treatment context in terms of working together as PEPFAR, the Global Fund, and other supporters of treatment to really sort of put the attribution issue aside and really focus on getting as many people on treatment as possible. We still have a challenge at times of tracking all the way down to the final recipients exactly where all the money is going. I think that's a continuing challenge for all of us. This was a slide that Jonathan Brown shared to sort of look at where are we as far as coordination and harmonization in the context of HIV. The grades on the panel that sort of discussed this ranged from a B minus to a B plus. I think everyone can sort of draw their own conclusions, but I think we've made some significant progress year by year. Each implementer's meeting, the grade seems to go up a bit more, but perhaps we offer a few more caveats to that grade at the same time. A couple messages in the coordination harmonization arena. Obviously, we need to do coordination in terms of strengthening sustainability. I mean, I think coordination in the short term is really important, but obviously the goal of coordination should be strengthening sustainability for the long term. In that, and I think, you know, the reauthorization of PEPFAR is one, you know, good sign in that direction. I think the continued growth of Global Fund funding, World Bank funding, et cetera, gives us an opportunity to look at longer term, more predictable, consistent funding, which gives governments confidence that money will continue to come. It helps NGOs and implementers who are receiving that money appreciate that that money will be coming not just for 1 year, but for multiple years, even if we can't strictly promise that, except on an annual basis. But I think even beyond financial resources, you know, we really need to look at how do we better harmonize and coordinate the provision of technical assistance. I think that as development partners, whether they're multilateral or bilateral, we all provide TA to our partners. I think trying to harmonize the provision of technical assistance so that it's more logical, more efficient, gets people TA that they really need when they need it, but that we don't have too many parallel systems providing technical assistance. And as I said before, looking at a division of labor, I think we've talked a lot about coordination. I also think complementarity and comparative advantage are very important things. There are always going to be limitations that development partners bring to the table. There are always going to be things that one partner, whether it's government, a development partner, NGOs, do better than others. And we should be looking at the full pie and who best can take that slice of the pie and do the work. And then we always need to remember whose agenda is being addressed. Is it the host country government's agenda? Is it a development partner agenda? Sometimes those agendas overlap. Sometimes they conflict. We need to engage in dialogue to figure out what's the best solution we can have to those often, you know, conflicting and sometimes overlapping priorities. some conclusions, and I hate to call these conclusions because I think it's an ongoing discussion and dialogue. We're still struggling a bit with indicators, not necessarily indicators for coordination, but I think indicators that help give us the confidence that the coordination gains we're making are showing greater efficiency as far as impact. I think we all know that we've dramatically increased service provision and coverage, but I think drawing that back to an improvement in coordination is a challenge for us. And as we talked about with governments on, you know, the MSM issue and others, the more evidence we have that coordination works and it's a worthwhile investment because it takes time and it takes commitment and it's not always easy, the more we can show that it really helps everyone to coordinate, the better off we'll be. We'll run through these pretty quickly, but as I said before, I think a technical support plan and a coordination of that plan really needs to flow from the national strategic plan, and those strategic plans often need to get more specific, better costed, so that we can then attach technical support to them in a more logical way. A couple quick points on the Global Fund. This is certainly not a comprehensive representation of everything that was discussed on the Global Fund. There was certainly some discussion around CCMs. What's the sort of most appropriate and essential role that CCMs play? Obviously, monitoring the implementation of grants at country level is a big one. I think there are three main elements to this. Certainly financial monitoring, programmatic monitoring, you know, how well is the money moving? How well are programmatic goals and work plans being adhered to? And then obviously performance. You know, what are the results of these grants and these resources? I think there were sort of five questions that emerged from the discussion around CCMs. There are probably many more questions that CCMs should be asking about active grants, but these five sort of came to the fore. Where's the money, both in terms of the pipeline, you know, all the way down from the fund itself to the principal recipient to subrecipients? Where are the commodities that are being purchased, since nearly half of Global Fund grants purchase commodities? It could be drugs, bed nets, other medical supplies. Are subrecipients receiving the resources and the technical assistance as planned? Are grants being implemented as planned, and are performance targets being met? I think these are all continued challenges for CCMs. We obviously heard from a variety of countries. Some CCMs are obviously functioning quite well. Others have a lot of challenges ahead, but we need to find some way that we continue to better monitor the funds that are flowing through the Global Fund. We can run through this quickly, but sort of what are some things that CCMs need to better perform this fairly important but difficult oversight function that they have? Sometimes better information is the simplest thing. Improved dialogue with principal recipients. Technical support. I mean, I think we often put a lot of a burden on CCMs, but we don't necessarily give them the TA that they need to do their job, and a range of other things. Public-private partnerships. Again, this is a snapshot view of some of the discussions around PPPs. I think one thing that came out is engaging the private sector, when done correctly, certainly increased the number of people reached with services. There was an example raised from Uganda, particularly in reaching hard-to-reach rural communities, where there was an 80% increase in access to counseling and testing. I think, as we've talked about with donors in the public sector, in the private sector, there are comparative advantages that the private sector has that the public sector doesn't. And I think it was discussed at the architecture discussion earlier today, but, you know, really looking at what should we be going to the private sector for? Is it money? Perhaps. But maybe the private sector really has in-kind contributions that are more valuable and scarcer in the public sector, and that's really where we should be targeting our interventions. And then obviously we need to continue to build the capacity of the private sector to engage effectively in a world that they may not understand, and engage with the public sector to have them better appreciate where the private sector can bring their value and resources to bear. A couple obstacles and issues. I think that the private sector and the public sector don't often understand each other very well. I think that there's some distrust of, you know, if you're the private sector, sort of getting into the government arena sounds a bit daunting. I think the public sector, particularly in the health sector, doesn't necessarily always appreciate at first blush what the private sector can bring to bear, particularly in a health-related context. And so I think we need to continue to advocate as those intermediaries so that people better understand the value that they can bring. There were a whole range of examples of tackling those issues. India, Vietnam were just a couple that were raised. Human resources, a big issue, and, you know, one that would be difficult to capture in a couple of slides. Obviously, we're all struggling with inadequacies in human resource capacity. It's certainly straining our systems. It's slowing down our ability to expand HIV care and treatment. It's putting a huge strain on those people who are already providing that treatment. Whether you look at people who are providing counseling and testing services, palliative care, I mean, you're putting an enormous OVC, you're putting an enormous burden on the existing resources in the field. Obviously, brain drain, whether it's from donor countries or from NGOs within those countries, is still a problem. We obviously need, and we'll get into this in task shifting, but we need to look at how can we take personnel, you know, who can provide basic services, give them mentoring, you know, so they can provide it both at lower cost and all the way down to the facility level. And obviously, I think, you know, we all realize whether it's prevention with positives or other interventions, we need to better engage and better utilize people living with HIV. And I think we've all said that and we've given lip service to it for a long time. We need to really think about how can we better systematize our approach to that. A couple conclusions, and again, I hate the word conclusions, but I mean, I think we really need to look at investing in human resource planning. Whether we're looking at a national strategic plan, a TA plan, we also really need to have comprehensive assessments of what resources are available in countries, at what tiers, whether they're doctors or nurses or clinical officers or barefoot doctors, for lack of a better term. We need to better appreciate what's available so we can better understand where the gaps we need to fill, help governments have the evidence to prioritize the policy decisions that would either free up nurses, for example, to prescribe ARVs, or look at changing curricula in training institutions to train more mid-level cadres, et cetera. And I think there's a code of conduct, and this has certainly been piloted in a range of countries around how should donors and NGOs operate vis-a-vis brain drain issues. Capacity building, task shifting, we've got into this a bit. These are only a couple of countries that were presented during the implementers meeting, but there were Namibia, Rwanda, Mozambique, Uganda, South Africa, all presented sort of early examples of their success with task shifting. All of those studies showed many things, but one thing they showed is that task shifting does save time for doctors, and I think we have a scarcity of doctors all over Africa, but not just in Africa, in many countries, and also of nurses and also of clinical officers. But we need to look at logical ways to try and make sure that doctors can really spend their time doing the most efficient things given their skill set. This was one example from Rwanda. If you look at the two bar graphs, these are sort of the number of MDs and the hours that were spent on HIV consultations versus their ability to provide either consultations in crisis situations around HIV or other services required in the healthcare sector. And through some early task shifting, we saw a 78% decrease in the demand on doctors to provide HIV care, which then freed them up for 183% more time to provide non-HIV-related care. So this is a pilot program, but I think it shows the promise we have if we do task shifting correctly. So a couple of things. I think task shifting both has value in the short term in terms of addressing some of the very immediate concerns with the healthcare worker crisis, but it's also part, although not full, a part of the long-term solution to building and better utilizing the capacity we have. Supply is still an issue. As much tasks as we shift, as many tasks that we had for doctors we give to nurses and nurses we give to clinical officers, we still need to create more supply. The fact of the matter is we just don't have enough boots on the ground to do all the work that's needed. Supervision and mentoring as we task shift is obviously important. And I think one of the things that is certainly true, and I can reflect on this from Kenya, but I'm sure it's true everywhere, we really need to not get rid of in-service training, but really focus on how can we better strengthen national training institutions so that pre-service training gives people more skills from the outset, so we're not trying to sort of mop up the mess with a bunch of Band-Aid approaches in an in-service context. And I think the fact of the matter is, as vogue as it is and as important as it is, task shifting will not solve all problems. Workplace programs. I think the public-private partnership model, you know, was talked about in a range of countries as a feasible delivery mechanism for workplace programs. I think as we've talked a lot about with government, but it's true with the private sector as well, we really need to get policy-level buy-in at the management level for workplace programs in an HIV context because issues like stigma, discrimination, fear of a loss of employment are very real risks still in very many countries, and we need to educate employers so that we're not setting up their employees in doing workplace programs for unintended consequences. And as part of that, I think we need to look at what is the evidence we need to provide to the public sector for them to appreciate that productivity will increase, it's a good investment that they'll get some returns on, and so it's a good thing to do. Lessons learned, we can skip over some of these, but I think We really need to formalize partnership agreements in terms of workplace. It really gives a clarity of role. What's the employer's job? What's the employee's job? I think it provides a particularly good opportunity to do a multi-sectoral response to look at what's the appropriate role for the private sector in what has traditionally been a public sector-driven HIV response. We can skip through a couple of these. Obviously, we've talked a lot about policy and enabling environments. Governments need to certainly work with the private sector in creating that environment so that there are incentives for them to take that lead. And obviously, you know, if we do workplace interventions right, it both increases public health and also productivity in the workplace. Strategic information, this was much discussed, and rightly so, at the conference at a variety of levels. I think one of the things we'll come to later is, I think before we were really struggling with a lack of data, and I think there's still huge gaps in data we need to gather. But I think the bigger challenge we have now is how do we manage the data we have, both in terms of routine reporting. We certainly have that in the context of PEPFAR, but I think governments are struggling with, as these programs get so big, particularly in some of the countries that have received massive increases in resources, how do they effectively manage an M&E system that now has so many inputs from so many different facilities? And also then, how do we translate that data into better policy and better programming at the national, regional, and local level? M&E systems have certainly gotten more complex. With that, I think we have more data to analyze, and we can analyze it in innovative and interesting ways. But that takes time, and we have to try and prioritize how we use that data. So I think there were sort of three levels. One, we talked about how do we use data in developing national plans, and not just developing them, but also improving them. Since most countries have national strategic plans, many of them, like Kenya, are going into a process this year of a midterm review of the plan. How do we use the data we have available? Kenya just did a national AIDS survey specific to HIV. There was a modes of transmission survey that was presented earlier in this conference. How do we use that data that's telling us both about program coverage, gaps, populations that we may not have realized being most at risk or now most at risk, such as, you know, discordancy in marriages, et cetera. How do we take that data and infuse it into the national plan development discussion so that those plans come out on the other end much improved? Obviously, we need to make sure that when we have those plans, if they're well-costed and well-thought-out, it makes it a lot easier for development partners to align themselves with those plans. I think one of the struggles has been where those plans have been sort of a grab bag of a wish list in some ways of interventions that we'd like to take, but we haven't prioritized based on the evidence we have what are the interventions we need to take. That then makes it easier for all partners to come together around that. Another area that we talked about in terms of strategic information is sort of how do we use data to really get that picture of the epidemic? How do we know our epidemic, and how do we set up data systems so they give us that information? And how do we recognize the data we don't have and explore areas where we don't have that data? Obviously, routine monitoring data is quite useful. It's something we gather as PEPFAR. It's something that all donors gather. It's something that all governments gather. We need to use that. We also need to understand its weaknesses and look for other ways to triangulate data sources with that data so we get a best picture possible of the epidemic. Local data is obviously challenging. National level data is easier. I think we should look for targeted ways that we find local data, but also be willing to, you know, take regional level data, national level data, and try and extrapolate from that as best we can until we're able to get the local level data. Lastly, I think we need to build the capacity of governments both to gather data and also to use data. Some of this is certainly learning by doing, certainly referenced in the presentation on prevention. We need to try and use practical exercise to show how data can use or be used in a programmatic context or a policymaking context. And we can probably skip through the rest. So I think in conclusion on the strategic information, I think we all realize we have a greater appreciation for how much we rely on data and how much we need it. We also recognize how much of it we have and how much we could do better in using the data that's already available. And again, I think, you know, really establishing national M&E systems that are integrated, that are comprehensive, that are robust, takes a lot of time and takes a big commitment. And I think countries, whether they're host country governments or donor partners, you know, need to continue to commit to that process, because otherwise we're really in the dark. And as I said before, I think earlier our bottlenecks were mostly that we didn't have information. Now we still have information we need to gather, but we also need to find ways to better utilize what we already have. Briefly, a couple last topics, procurement, and this is specific to the Global Fund. I think there were other issues around procurement that came up at the conference, but there were a couple messages that came out around particularly pharmacy supply management, and that these should be supplied and prepared early in submission to the Global Fund. Also that principal recipients should work closely with their CCM when completing these management documents and follow the policy guidance that the Global Fund has put out so there's some consistency in that. And also that the procurement folks need to closely align themselves with the programmatic team because we need to make sure that the predictions about commodities that are needed are as accurate as possible based on as many assumptions that we can make, because otherwise we do procurements, then we end up with programs that are, you know, needing twice as many of this commodity or three times as many of this one, and the procurements aren't really serving the needs of those end recipients. Lessons learned, I think Rwanda, among other countries, was cited as a very good example of a well-planned procurement plan. And I think we need to try and better support CCMs so that they can provide country-level TA in the development of these plans. Lastly, and this certainly does not cover this topic and give justice to everything that was presented, but I think there was one particularly telling example from the Indian Network of People Living with HIV where they were really taking sort of their advocacy role on and seeing some real positive influence as far as policy change at the national level. There was representation of IMP Plus on the CCM, the National AIDS Control Committee, HIV-TB Coordination Committee, and others. They'd done training for 1,000 people living with HIV from the network, from 22 state-level networks, as public speakers, giving them skills so they could advocate effectively in those arenas. They conducted 100 policy sessions with government and other stakeholders to really voice the demands and concerns of their networks and the PLHIV community. And just two results of that, and I'm sure there are many more from the abstract and others, but second-line treatment was made available after having not been available in the country through their advocacy. There was an HIV bill that was drafted and not just sort of visited upon IMP Plus, but the development of the plan was actually done in consultation with members of the Indian Network of People Living with HIV. So I think that's, you know, sort of one example of how we can better use people living with HIV and tap into all their knowledge and all their expertise and all their capacities, not just at a programmatic level, but also at a policy and advocacy level. And acknowledgements. Certainly the conference could not have happened without the government or the people of Uganda. We owe a huge debt of gratitude to them and all the participants, organizers, and certainly the rapporteurs. I was not among them, but I certainly, looking through the information and even trying to glean from the many slides we had, the couple of slides that were presented today, it was certainly a thankless task. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any question? Yeah, we have a, yes, please. You beat him this time, yeah, okay.
Thank you very much. My name is Scott Naismith, and I work for the Health Economics HIV/AIDS Research Division in Durban and also at the London School of Economics. You spoke a lot about harmonization and data, and these are two seemingly exclusive issues, but I think they're closely related. I think that harmonization and coordination requires openness and transparency, and this means that expenditure data, and data in general, needs to be shared and openly available to the recipients and to the public. In turn, I think this really leads to greater accountability of programming and reflects the policymaking, and in turn leads to greater harmonization. I was wondering if you could speak to, with reference to the meeting in Kampala, if you could speak to the fact that PEPFAR still guards expenditure data and recipient data, and so it makes it difficult for recipients to know where the money's going and where the public can derive this information from, so that we can better scrutinize the way that these programs are implemented. I think it's really important to realize that data has only become available from PEPFAR through legal action against the State Department. And I was wondering if you can speak to the fact that PEPFAR still guards data, even though places like the Global Fund make it openly available.
Sammy? You want to react? No, please react.
Okay. Yeah, thank you for your question. I think that there are certainly some legal restrictions that we're contractually bound to as far as how we're able to release data. I would not be a lawyer, so I'm not going to get into sort of muddy legal grounds on what we're allowed to or not release. I can certainly refer you to folks in our office who would better be able to explain exactly what the limitations are and why they're in that situation. So I'm sorry to have to defer on that, but I'm not in a position to comment.
Thank you. Yes?
This is my last question of the night. There is a gap of intervention of PEPFAR within Africa. There is no, I mean, one of the things that I've seen that there's no Central African countries which involve in intervention of PEPFAR. Given the fact that now we have a lot of countries getting involved in the broad usage of antiretroviral medication, and given the fact that in that Central African region, we have the highest diversity of HIV strains and recombinant strains, and is there any limitation why PEPFAR is not involved in that region?
Did you get the question? Yes?
I think you were saying, why isn't PEPFAR involved in Central Africa?
Yes.
I mean, I think that, as you may know from the beginning of PEPFAR, PEPFAR focuses in 15 countries, but we have programs in over 100 countries. So I think the lion's share of resources have gone to those 15 countries, which at the time of PEPFAR's initiation accounted for over 50% of HIV infections globally. But PEPFAR provides support all over the world, and I think, you know, in the next phase of PEPFAR, there will probably be more opportunities for more resources, particularly new resources, to go to other countries. But exactly what those countries are is still to be determined. The legislation was just passed last week, so. But there certainly aren't hard and fast restrictions on any countries receiving funding or not. It's just been that those 15 countries, to really make some headway and show that progress was possible, where I think a lot of people doubted that we could make a dent in the epidemic, that was really the first phase.
Thank you very much. Another question? Gentile, no question from you? I'm surprised. Okay. So thank you very much for really this interesting discussion on feedback from implementers' meetings. And I appreciate really your feedback from science point of view, programmatic response, and enabling environment. I can just say that those are the three major areas we have been addressing. But before just giving you the opportunity to leave this room, I will ask again to our panelists, if we have to take only one thing from your presentation, what it would be, starting by you.
I think we just need to get more creative about how we approach systems, and I think we need to look for different models and use, and I must be honest, I think what I find very frustrating about conferences, it's all about my fabulous program and about what it's like, you know, my summer holiday almost and what went well, and I learned so much more hearing how what mistakes people made, what things they did and what they did wrong and what they're picking up the pieces of afterwards. And I think the implementers program, oddly enough, was a little bit more like that. There were a lot of people putting out there the stuff that they put out there, how frustrating they found this information leaflets and how they try to do this and all that. So I guess for me, what I'd like to see more is this honest approach of looking at what didn't work in your systems and what we might be able to do better going into the future.
Thank you. Rene, from the programmatic point of view.
I wanted to raise the issue of system strengthening, but I think Francois will be raised. I think the point, at least relates to what I presented in terms of prevention, is that we need more evidence actually to really understand the epidemic. Understanding the epidemic will help us actually to do the right thing instead of trying to do things right, which is very important. And again, in this area, it's very important, while we're actually looking for more evidence, also to adopt the principle of also learning by doing, which is very important at programmatic level.
Thank you. Navin?
Sure. I mean, I think I would certainly mostly echo the comments of Francois. I mean, I think that part of the environment that we're hoping to create now is an environment where people can really admit what's working, admit what's not, and without any consequences, without any concerns of sort of implications for what that would be. Because, I mean, I think there's so much information out there about what's working. And yes, it's often at a small community-based level. And you know, sometimes we get enamored with one example from one country and we decide that that's sort of the solution for everywhere. But I also think that there's a real opportunity, as Francois was talking about, to learn from the mistakes we've made. I mean, I can't tell you how many times just in Kenya, you know, someone will come to me with an idea and, you know, it's very rare that there's a brand new idea that hasn't been tried in some way or some part of it hasn't been tried somewhere. And that's where I think using places like the implementers meeting, and we can continue to improve how that meeting, you know, works, you know, really using that opportunity to say, we're all facing similar issues, and some of us have tried things, and some of them have worked, and some of them haven't. But let's at least start from, you know, 20 or 30% of the way toward a solution that might work, rather than beginning again, you know, in another country or another community with starting from scratch. So I think that opportunity is great. I think we have the opportunity here. I think the implementers meeting is a very nice complement to this conference. I think it continues to be really useful in enhancing what's happening here, but also, you know, bringing together a slightly smaller group so we can have more intensive discussions, you know, at a smaller level around sort of programmatic experience.
Thank you very much for being with us, and I hope it was useful for you. But thank you. I learned a lot. Thanks.
Thank you. Good to see you again.